And Radio Derb is on the air. This is your truculently genial host, John Derbyshire, with some raisins plucked from this week's news buns. I leave the boring dough for our mainstream media news organs. Here, tuned to my organ, supported as it is by the labours of my indefatigable assistants Mandy, Candy and Brandy, you get the sweet, juicy raisins. I shall resist the urge to extend my metaphor further for fear I may wander into some inappropriate allusion to buns. So let's just hasten forth and examine a few of those raisins. There was a little flurry of off-year election results. I shall take them in turn and then point a moral. New York's mayoral election was won, to the surprise of no one at all, by Bill de Blasio, 73% to 24%. De Blasio is so flawlessly and spotlessly a cultural Marxist that, if cultural Marxism was a dog breed, he'd win prizes at Crufts. The exit polls did contain a few surprises. Joe Lota, the opposition Republican candidate, who spent most of the campaign hotly denying that he had anything whatsoever to do with those unwashed, gap-toothed, knuckle-dragging Tea Party bigots, managed to get 44% of the Jewish vote, smashing the old New York stereotype that Jews earn like Episcopalians but vote like Puerto Ricans. Lota also did better the further up the educational scale you go, peaking at 29% of the postgraduate vote. All right, 29%'s not a lot, but Lota still bucked the trend of Republicans doing well in the educational middle, but badly at the top and the bottom. Otherwise, things were as you'd expect. De Blasio got the women's vote over the men's, the black vote over the white, the young vote over the old, and the homosexual vote over the normal. The biggest margins were, of course, racial. 90% for de Blasio among Hispanic women, 95% among black men, 97% among black women. At this point, I would normally say, so much for Barack Obama's post-racial America. But frankly, I'm tired of saying it. I see no reason to think that de Blasio's mayoral career will deviate from the usual pattern of far-left governance, which is a couple of years of wild spending on public services. Translation: jobs for dull-witted, paper-shuffling bureaucrats and well-connected seat-warmers. Followed by a general collapse of revenues and public order. As the late, great Margaret Thatcher put it so incontrovertibly, socialism works just fine until you run out of other people's money. Republican Chris Christie won an easy victory, 61 to 39%, in his bid for a second term as governor of New Jersey. Of course, nobody cares about Christie's governorship, except, I suppose, the residents of the Garden State. What everyone's thinking about is a Christie run for president in 2016 as candidate of the Republican Party. Presidentially, I think the GOP could do a lot better than Christie. At the levels Christie's been working in so far, I'll give him some not very enthusiastic nods of approval. There were a few soft brown spots on his record as US attorney, but nothing I know of that doesn't fairly come under the heading "politics ain't beanbag." As governor, Christie's been fiscally responsible, and that's not nothing. He's talked a good game against the voracious public sector unions, although friends in the state tell me that his bark's been worse than his bite with the unions. On the other side, Christie has been clueless on the immigration issue and worse than clueless on gun rights. When I asked him face to face about the gun issue, Christie said, quote, "I was in law enforcement. I understand the necessity of gun control," end quote. How that understanding has translated into practice was described by my shooting buddy, Tom, over at Radio Free New Jersey back in August. Quote, "Chris Christie signed the raft of new gun regulations the legislature sent him that were designed to prohibit the legal ownership of firearms by law-abiding citizens. Most of them are just expansions of the already ridiculous New Jersey laws, but I think one in particular stands out. From now on, if your name is on the terrorist watch list, you are banned from obtaining a firearm legally in New Jersey. The terrorist watch list itself is secret, and there is no process for having your name removed once it's been added. I guess the way you find out you've been added is when you attempt to buy a gun and can't. So, once you're on it, you have in effect had your Second Amendment rights suspended. This is a suspension of a constitutional right, without due process. No conviction, hell, not even an accusation, and your rights have been eliminated." End quote. On immigration, Christie is, as I said, clueless. Just this summer, he travelled to Las Vegas to kiss the ring of hotel and casino billionaire and open borders fanatic Sheldon Adelson, and no doubt received campaign funding in return. Immigration restrictionist websites have been scathing about Christie's pandering to immigration romantics and cheap labour business interests, grading the Republican presidential candidates in the 2012 election cycle. Numbers USA put Christie last with a grade F. The Federation for American Immigration Reform, back in the mid-2000s, estimated the annual cost of illegal immigration to New Jersey as $1.6 billion, a sum Christie did nothing to reduce, even when, as US attorney, he had some power in immigration enforcement. As governor, he did less than nothing. All his much-touted early budgetary reforms just barely covered that loss due to welfare, medical, education, housing subsidies, and incarceration for illegal aliens, which of course has gotten much greater since the FAIR report. So count me a definite no vote on Christie as presidential candidate, and a lukewarm maybe, I guess, on Christie as governor. I'll say this for the guy, though. He has a personality. And no, I don't mean that as a synonym for being fat. That abrasive quality, that firmness in sticking to his positions, that smash-mouth response to public sector whiners is bracing. Not many of our coached, blow-dried, focus group-tested, consultant-approved politicians have discernible or distinctive personality. I still have trouble telling the difference between Paul Ryan and Eric Cantor. Or is it Paul Cantor and Eric Ryan? Whatever. Christie has a personality for sure. Even discounting for the blubber, you wouldn't mistake him for anyone else. I just wish that candour and that firmness could be employed in the service of constitutional fidelity and patriotic concern for citizens over foreigners. The third noteworthy election result was in Virginia, where Democrat Terry McAuliffe won narrowly, 48% to 46, against Republican Ken Cuccinelli. The mainstream media spin here is that Cuccinelli lost because he was too socially conservative. His opposition to abortion and homosexual marriage, we are told, turned off the better class of GOP voters. The exit polls support this to some degree. Voters in the 50,000 to 100,000 annual income range went 51% for Cuccinelli. In the $100,000 plus range, he got only 43%, while McAuliffe got 49%. Same with the education breakdown. Cuccinelli dominated in the lower middle part of the range, high school graduates and people with some college. But he flopped badly with graduates and postgraduates. If you look closer, though, Cuccinelli's failure was a replay of Mitt Romney's last year. One of the biggest numbers in the exit polls was the 13 percentage point drop in Republican support from white men. Even among white women, the drop was 9%. All right, Virginia's a tough circle to square. In the north, you have a lot of dormitory communities for government people from Washington, D.C. The south is more Robert E. Lee country. Of the last six governors, three were Democrats, three were Republicans. With the failure of Obamacare all over the news, though, Cuccinelli really should have done better. So, of course, up against a lackluster administration with a growing rap sheet of scandals and incompetences, so should Mitt Romney. Time to point the moral. Republicans aren't going to win any elections on against, even when there's lots to be against. They need to be for something. Tax reduction, which no one really believes in, and social issues like abortion and homosexuality, which are boutique issues, aren't going to do it. Even proven managerial competence against the absence of such isn't going to win, as Lotus loss in New York City illustrates. How about being for US sovereignty over internationalism? How about being for Americans over foreigners? How about being for enforcing laws against ignoring them? How about being for American workers against cheap labor lobbies? How about being for private citizens and private enterprise against organized race lobbies and public sector unions? Come to think of it, how about being for voters against donors? Might be worth a try. The billboard is a fine American art form. Remember the old Burma shave billboards? Nobody knows the stubble I've seen? Poet Ogden Nash, channeling earlier poet Joyce Kilmer, penned the following, quote, "I think that I shall never see a billboard lovely as a tree. Indeed, unless the billboards fall, I'll never see a tree at all." Well, I got billboard stories. Here we go. Billboard story one. Billboard story one advertises a product named Snore Stop, which, believe it or not, claims to stop you snoring. A billboard advertising Snore Stop was erected on Sunset Boulevard in Los Angeles. It shows a white European US Army soldier with his arm affectionately around a woman in a black burqa, just her eyes showing. The legend, quote, "Snore Stop, keeping you together," end quote. There was some fringe reaction from Islamophobes and fundamentalist Muslims, but most Americans didn't know what to make of it. The most penetrating comment came from Ruben over at the Jew Among You blog. I'll just quote him. Edited quote. Muslims do not form a major power bloc in the Los Angeles area. At least they're not powerful enough to demand that infidels stay away from their women. This is not the case in much of Western Europe. It seems to me that such a billboard, if erected in a place like France, for example, would elicit immediate negative reactions. Various reasons for the outrage would be given, but few would come out and state the real reason. Underdogs contribute the females, while overlords contribute the males. European Muslims feel entitled to native women because they are allowed to be the overlords, while the native population is subjugated. A billboard such as this implies the opposite. As such, it would be considered offensive. In fact, it would probably even be illegal. End quote. That's Ruben, and I think Ruben's right. Second billboard story. A person in or near the town of Harrison, Arkansas, paid for a billboard on a local highway with no pictures on it at all. Only the words, visible from half a mile away, quote, anti-racist is a code word for anti-white. Which is, of course, quite true. The billboard went up October 17th, and so far as I can discover, it's still standing. Apparently, the anonymous renter has signed a contract to have the sign up there for 1 year. Town officials hastened to grab their ankles. The mayor's office issued a statement saying, inter alia, edited quote, the mayor's office considers the content inflammatory, distasteful, and not in line with the truth on how Harrison is a city of welcoming and tolerant citizens. The owners of the signage and the owners of the structure should be ashamed to display such antiquated ideology and hatred that adversely affects Harrison as a whole. End quote. I repeat, the message is a true one. If the truth is an antiquated ideology, we're in worse trouble than I thought. When was anyone other than a white person in trouble for being racist? I never heard of such a case. When did any non-white person ever lose a job, a contract, a government position, or an election because of alleged racism? The only people whose lives or careers are blighted by action on the part of the anti-racist lobbies are white people. Ergo, anti-racist is a code word for anti-white. I congratulate the billboard's sponsor for spending his own money to put the truth out there where people can see it. I'm sorry, although entirely understanding, that under the soft totalitarianism of the modern West, he can only do so anonymously. Third and final billboard story is not really about a billboard, though I think I can fairly include it here. It's yet another loan from Ruben at Jew Among You. What can I tell you? The guy's on a roll and the girls find stories where they can. The mass transit system in Portland, Oregon, which is called MAX, is running an ad, or a series of ads, called Respect the Ride, urging riders to make sure they have valid tickets, give up their seats to senior citizens, and so on. One of the ads admonishes MAX riders not to talk too loudly on their cell phones. It's illustrated with a cartoon picture of rider A in the foreground yapping loudly on her cell phone, while rider B in the background wears an expression of pained annoyance. Rider A, the yapper, is a white female. Rider B, the yappy with the pained expression, is a black male. If you can tell me with a straight face that this corresponds to your experience of people talking too loud on their cell phones in your city's mass transit, I'll award you this week's Radio Derb Belt Buckle Award for anti-racist goodthink. Brand new from the mayor's office in Harrison, Arkansas. Always first with the news, Radio Derb alerted listeners to the advent of the self-driving car back in October 2010. Google, we noted, had already at that point clocked up 140,000 miles in their test vehicle, including street driving in San Francisco. 3 years on from that, the news stories and features on self-driving cars are coming thick and fast. All the big auto companies have test vehicles out, with the German company Daimler, which owns the Mercedes mark, said to be in the lead. Since 90% of traffic accidents involve human error, there is the prospect of much safer roads. Or is there? Technology Review ran an article by Will Knight, throwing a little cold water on the self-driving car hype. Sample quote. MIT professor John Leonard suggested that much of the technology that has helped autonomous cars deal with complex urban environments in research projects, some of which is used in Google's cars today, may never be cheap or compact enough to be employed in commercially available vehicles. End quote. A hat tip there to Randall Parker of Future Pundit. I reserve judgment. It's certainly the case that some technological dreams never become reality. 50 years ago, I was reading exciting articles in the science magazines about fusion power, which, we were told, would solve all our energy needs just as soon as a few minor glitches had been fixed. 50 years ago. Today they're still working on those glitches. I privately wonder if quantum computing isn't the fusion power of the present generation, always just over the horizon, but somehow never arriving. Rather like post-racial America. Be that as it may, we should hold out hope for, if not fully autonomous cars, at least the great improvements in steering, braking and trouble avoidance systems that we might get from this research. Those of us, it has to be a very substantial minority, if not an actual majority, those of us who have lost friends or relatives to traffic accidents know how wretchedly futile such deaths seem. What a pointless waste. Anything that reduces their numbers will be very welcome to Radio Derb. Articles about China being the next great world power have been filling up the newsprint for a lot longer than the ones about self-driving cars. Here, there really is cause for scepticism. The China of 30 years ago was very much poorer than a nation of that many people, with that much intellectual capital and that long a tradition of civilized government, had any right to be. That China would eventually get up to speed and back in the international swim of things should not have surprised anybody. It really hasn't been a miracle. It was more of a miracle that Mao Zedong managed to keep his talented and industrious people in third world economic backwardness for 30 years. World leadership is a different matter. The Chinese state, as presently constructed, has very serious systemic problems. The most serious of them relating to governmental corruption, management of the environment, and China's determination to hold on to the old imperial territories of Tibet and eastern Turkestan, left over from the Manchu dynasty. We got a glimpse of these stresses following an event on November 6th. The event was the detonation of several bombs outside the headquarters of the provincial government in Taiyuan, capital of Shanxi province. Taking a Chinese province as equivalent to an American state, Shanxi isn't really a big player, but it also isn't a small one. Approximately an Ohio. The real news story wasn't the explosions themselves, which only seemed to have killed one person and broken a lot of windows, but the reaction to them on the Chinese internet. There was a surprising, and to the Chinese authorities, undoubtedly alarming, level of support for the bombings, fueled by widespread hatred of corrupt government officials. Quote from a news report that is itself quoting from Weibo, the Chinese equivalent of Twitter. Outer quote. One Weibo user wrote that under enough government pressure, quote, common people are all possible terrorists, end quote. Another wrote that, quote, people explode, end quote, when the pressure is high enough. Many users went even further, directly cheering or encouraging the violence. Examples of angry, even violent rhetoric abound. One user asked whether, quote, any of those dog fuckers inside, end quote, the government building had been killed. Another wrote, quote, no matter how bad it is, you should not hurt innocent people. You should blow up a few corrupt officials, end quote. One reasoned, quote, anyone who harms the masses is a terrorist, but harming an official is vengeance, end quote. End outside quote. Like fusion power, and possibly like quantum computing and the self-driving car and a post-racial America, China's plans for world mastery have a few glitches to be worked out yet. Microaggression of the week is turning out to be not so micro. The United Nations actually got involved in this one. Here's the backstory. In the Netherlands, which when I was a kid in England we called Holland, without that annoying the, and which I think, just to be ornery, I shall call Holland for the rest of this broadcast. In Holland, as in other North European countries, the character of Saint Nicholas features largely in the midwinter celebrations. In the Dutch language, they call him Sinterklaas. St. Nicholas's name day is actually December 6th, as readers of War and Peace will remember. On the day before that, St. Nicholas Eve, there's a big traditional celebration centred around Sinterklaas and his helpers. Therein lies the microaggression. In Holland, Santa's helpers are not elves, they are gollywogs. Well, that's what we used to call them in England. Gollywog figures came up all over the Western world in the middle 19th century as a form of children's doll. A Negro figure with all the Negro features, the black skin, the woolly black hair, the thick red lips, all exaggerated for comic effect. No malice was intended, it was just a striking figure that would get a small child's attention. Folklorists have traced some deeper connections, for example to the dark-skinned Moors of North Africa, defeated and ultimately expelled by Spanish monarchs in the late Middle Ages. But basically, we're talking kids' entertainment here. In Holland, then, Santa's helpers are gollywogs, known individually as Zwarte Piet. That's Black Piet. Plural Zwarte Pieten. Black Piet shows up with Santa and hands out candy to kids. These Black Piets are actually, of course, white people in blackface with lipstick and wigs. You can hear the PC alarms going off in government offices, school administrations and police precinct houses all over the Western world. As the late Larry Oster pointed out, the Negro is a sacred object in the modern liberal imagination, so this traditional Dutch celebration is blasphemous. The Inquisition has swung into action. The United Nations Human Rights Council has established a, quote, working group, end quote, to, quote, investigate, end quote, the Black Pete custom. Head of this working group is a lady named Vereen Shepherd, formerly head of the Department of Making White People Feel Guilty at the University of Jamaica. I'm glad to report that the people of Holland are putting up some resistance to the Gollywog Slayers. Quote from a news report, October 30th, quote, on Saturday, hundreds of people demonstrated in The Hague and Nijmegen to keep Black Pete black. In Nijmegen, an attempt was made to break the record number of Zwarte Pieten pictured in one photograph. End quote. A Facebook page in support of keeping Black Pete as he has traditionally been has gotten 2.1 million likes. That's one in three Dutch Facebook users. A page for people who want to clean up Black Pete has only 12,000 likes. That's one in 500 users. The protest is all very North European, of course, with many whimpering protestations that wir sehen nicht rassistisch, which is Dutch for we're not racist. The explanation going around is that the Black Peets are only black from shinnying down the chimneys with the Christmas presents. Sounds bogus to me. Why wouldn't Santa himself be black on the same principle? Or if Santa just sends his helpers down the chimneys, why aren't his American elves all black too? These are deep theological waters, though. Probably Professor Shepherd has a couple of experts in her working group who are competent to explore them. I'm not. I just long for the day when someone, somewhere, will stand up to these worthless, useless, busybody guilt mongers and respond to the accusation of racism by telling these parasites to go home and boil their heads and get real jobs doing useful work and leave white people alone, as they currently leave all other kinds of people to enjoy their harmless traditions in peace. I'm afraid, ladies and gentlemen, as sometimes happens, I am over my time allowance, so we must forego the miscellany of brief items this week and hasten directly to Franz Joseph Haydn. More from Radio Derb next week.